Morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We'll give you a minute to get settled.
Thank you.
I'm just going to go over a few preliminary matters. The final case on our calendar today is A22-1762, State of Minnesota versus Donelante Jamar Wade. Hopefully I pronounced that name correctly, but you can...
You did, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Perfectly.
We are recording the oral argument here today. The recording will be available on our website within 24 hours or so. Appellant will have 5 minutes, not 5 minutes, excuse me. I'm getting tired and it's not even noon, but appellant will have 15 minutes for your initial argument. Respondent will have 15 minutes and then there will be an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant. At the start of your argument, we would appreciate it if you can introduce yourself and the party you represent. There's a podium available. It is adjustable and it also shows the time remaining. There's a clock there. So you can track your time. And appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Not quite as high as the last gentleman. Or I should say the prior to the last gentleman. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Francis Herbert White III. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Donelante Jamar Wade. Essentially, Your Honors, this is a relatively easy case. This is a simple case because this case is about whether or not an individual has a property and liberty interest in a lower sentence from which he can be deprived in a criminal proceeding to an agreement to which he agreed based solely on the accusations of an undisputed and unfettered administrative agency action for which the district court judge took judicial notice and of probable cause finding in a different county under a different criminal procedure.
But that isn't the only thing that's alleged, is it? It was a violation? Wasn't there also allegation of violation of the electronic home monitoring?
Yes, Your Honor. That is what I mean by when I say the unfettered administrative agency. The administrative agency was the one who submitted the report to the district court who said he had violated his electronic home monitoring. That is correct, Your Honor.
Was that challenged in the district court?
I believe it was, Your Honor, although it was challenged what one might call obliquely. It was challenged because it related directly to the circumstance, the totality of the circumstance by which Mr. Wade had been detained and found in violation, or excuse me, claimed to have been found in violation of the electronic home monitoring.
Did you request a hearing on the violation?
Again, Your Honor, obliquely. It was not corrected. It was not requested emphatically, but it was requested implicitly.
How was it implicitly requested?
No problem, Your Honor. I requested that because I asked the court to not make a determination on this, to say that he had not been found in violation of this, because he had not actually violated those conditions of release that on the totality of the circumstances, and that was at the sentencing hearing transcript, page 3, paragraphs 18 and 19. And Mr. Wade himself said in the same statement, so I would hope that the court would let me continue to do what I was doing, or at least let me prove my innocence. And that was at same transcript, page 8.
So I understand it. There was an electronic home monitoring allowance for a very specific period of time.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And your client was incarcerated in another county outside of the time.
That is the allegation, yes, Your Honor.
I mean, that is something that is a fact that is not reasonably subject to dispute. He was in that jail outside of the period of time that he was allowed to be outside of his home.
He was incarcerated as a result of the actions of Isanti County when they arrested him.
So I don't see why it was an abuse of discretion or clearly erroneous for the district court to say, or an error of law for the district court to say, I'm taking judicial notice of the fact that he was not where he was supposed to be, because I know he was elsewhere on a date that he was supposed to be at home.
In order for him to have known that and to take judicial notice of that, he would have had to taken some type of evidence. And as it was, he relied solely on the report from probation that says that he was not in compliance with his home monitor.
And why is that the case? I mean, judicial notice is an evidentiary threshold that does not necessarily require a hearing, or, I mean, it's a fact that's not reasonably subject to dispute. So I don't know why a hearing would be required to establish that indisputable fact.
I don't agree, Your Honor, that that's indisputable, that's an indisputable fact. But nevertheless, I listened to your questions in the last argument. And I understood that you had some concern about challenging the constitutionality of something. And this is similar to what transpired in that case related to your question. It is an administrative action from an administrative agency for which the court took judicial notice that impinged upon the constitutional rights of Mr. Wade for that period of time, to which he had agreed. I will concede that, but for which he should have had the opportunity to challenge that, and both he and I asked for that opportunity, and I asked the court to take notice that there are no magic words. There are no magic words that are necessary for someone to take note or to ask a court to address their constitutional rights.
I just want to make sure I understood the transcript in the proceeding. I thought that what you were challenging was the fact that he was being charged with another crime, not that he was violating the electronic home monitoring.
We were challenging the totality of it. He was charged with another crime, which was the proximate cause of an alleged violation of the home monitoring.
Can you point us to where in the transcript we can read that? Because I've read the transcript,
Your Honor, colleagues,
and I interpreted it in the same manner as Judge Smith, so I guess I would appreciate if you could point us to where you think there's support for your position.
For the plea hearing transcript, Your Honor, there are several transcripts in this matter, but I'm speaking specifically of the plea hearing transcript. If you go to page 3. Okay. On line 18, I stated to Judge Cahill, he has not actually violated those conditions of release. Okay? That was the main clause of the sentence, not the subordinate clause. The arrest that took place there was the causation of a alleged violation of his home monitoring. As far as the statement that my client made, upon which I am relying, that is on page 8,
mm-hmm.
Line 5. Where Mr. Wade stated to Judge Cahill himself, so I would hope that the court would let me continue to do what I was doing, or at least let me prove my innocence. His request right there was a inferred, implied request to allow him an opportunity to prove the charges against him that were resulting in the increased sentence were not warranted. He should have been afforded an opportunity to this. As I was saying about magic words, Your Honor, in 1955, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called MSPAC v. U.S. at 39 U.S. 190, pin site 194, stated, there is no ritualistic formula or talismanic phrase that is essential in order to invoke the privilege against self-incrimination. That related to someone who had used, shall we say, inferred or implied language to invoke his right, his Fifth Amendment rights, in a House Un-Americans hearing. He refused to answer a question.
Was there a request to withdraw the plea?
No, Your Honor. There was no request to withdraw the plea.
Wouldn't that be the appropriate remedy for if?
No, Your Honor, that would not be the remedy. And the fact that there was no request to draw the plea actually makes this case inopposite to some of the case law that the state has cited in their responsive brief, which is factually distinctual from the case before the court. In 1969...
Counsel, I don't disagree with you that magic words aren't necessary here. But the district court also is not a mind reader, and it does need to have some indication that there's an affirmative request for something. I want a hearing. I need to present some evidence. I think that we need to hold, I want to call the probation officer or the conditional release supervisor and have them come up here to say how they accumulated this evidence. There wasn't any of that in the transcript.
If "let me try to prove my innocence" is not enough of an affirmative statement to invoke a request for a hearing to prove something, then I would ask that this court state so implicitly and do so in a published opinion.
I mean, that might, let's assume that let me prove my innocence are magic words or are sufficient words, wouldn't that only go to the allegation that he was not law-abiding?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because as I stated earlier, the allegation that he was not law-abiding was the proximate cause of the allegation that he was not in compliance with his electronic home monitoring. Had there been an evidentiary hearing, it would have come out in the evidence, and it's not in the record, and I understand you can't consider it, that Mr. Wade had in fact contacted probation, and he was told, don't worry about it. So that whole point there would have been at least partially moot. There is a plethora of case law, most of it in dissent, I grant you, where prominent jurists have stated that there are no magic words, that the magic words that are necessary to invoke a right just don't exist. In Zuber v. Allen, 396 U.S. 168, Penn site 208, 1969, Justice Black said, agency interpretation cannot hinge on, quote, incantation of proper magic words. Carlson v. Green, 46, U.S. 14, Penn site 31, note 2 in 1980, Chief Justice Berger, in his dissent, said, Bivens remedies should not be extended simply because Congress failed to use the right magic words of limitation. Reed v. Farley, 512, U.S. 339, 368, 1994, Justice Blackmun in his dissent, defendants should not be deprived of dismissal remedy for violation of speedy trial rules because he failed to utter magic words at the magic moments. Berghaus v. Tompkins, 560, U.S. 370, 410, and 2010, Justice Sotomayor in her dissent said, criminal defendants should not have to invoke magic words to assert the right to silence. In more recent cases, NLB v. Nolan Garling, in a transcript before the United States Supreme Court, number 12-12, 81. On January 13th, 2014, the Chief Justice stated that distinction based on magic words cannot be, quote, that significant. That's at the oral argument 1225 through dash 13-4. And finally, Garland v. Ming Dai, 141 Supreme Court, 169, at 1679 in 2021, not in a dissent, the court stated that no magic words were required to determine the credibility on appeal from an administrative agency. The administrative agencies should not be afforded more rights than a citizen of the United States. A citizen of the United States should not be deprived of a property or liberty interest simply because the quote-unquote magic words were failed to be uttered at the appropriate time. Mr. Wade and I did put the district court on notice that he was not satisfied with finding the finding the judge made. And if judicial notice is sufficient, again, I ask this court to say that a statement of probable cause and or judicial notice of an administrative agency document is adequate to deprive someone of their 14th and Fifth Amendment rights. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm appellant's sentence because this court's precedents in State versus Batchelor and State versus Montez conclusively decide this issue. Appellant entered into a valid conditional plea agreement. The appellant violated conditional release, violating or justifying the greater guideline sentence that the district court imposed. Montez, in particular, addresses the exact arguments raised here, that just an allegation of new charges is enough to find a violation of conditional release. And Montez, this court in Montez did reject this type of argument. And additionally, State versus Batchelor addresses sort of the due process concerns that are now being raised for the first time upon appeal. And so the state of Minnesota today is simply asking that this court follow the precedents in Montez and Batchelor in particular and affirm appellant's sentence. And at this time, I'm happy to answer any questions that the panel has.
So, counsel, I have a little concern over the procedure that was used by the district court here to ostensibly take judicial notice of a conditional release violation report. It doesn't seem to me that a document containing allegations of violations are necessarily facts that are not reasonably subject to dispute. Do you want to comment on that, on the propriety of labeling this as a judicial notice?
Right. In the state's view, I think that it's comparable to what was done in State versus Montez, and there the district court, the finding that was made was based on the PSI. And so in the state's view, a conditional release violation report filed in district court is a comparable document to a pre-sentence investigation filed in district court. And both of them basically were indicating that new charges, you know, had occurred. I think that it's a comparable document. And in State versus Montez, this court had no problem with the finding being based on the PSI.
There's a distinction, though, between the existence of new charges and a failure to remain law-abiding, right? One involves a conviction that you've actually not been law-abiding, and one involves an allegation that you have not been law-abiding, right?
Right, yes. And I mean, I think in Montez, it was the same set of facts in terms of the defendant had been charged with new crimes, had not yet been convicted.
Mm-hmm. But in... correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought in Montez it the condition was that the defendant avoid even being charged with a crime.
It did say that. And here the conditional release order, I believe, says obey all laws. which, I mean, it doesn't say no new convictions. I think that, in my mind, is...
Obeying laws is different than being charged with a crime. You can be charged with a crime and be acquitted later, right?
Sure, right. I mean, I think in my mind, obey all laws is broad enough to encompass not getting new charges supported by probable cause. And I think here, I mean, the fact of the matter is he also violated electronic home monitoring. So I think, you know, and the district court was clear that it was both of those bases on which he was finding that conditional release was violated. And I think here, obviously, that finding was being made based on the conditional release violation report. And in the state's view, that would be an appropriate way to make that finding. Not one, but two district court judges actually found that he had violated conditional release based upon that report. Essentially, if appellant wished to challenge that and say, I want to prove I did not violate conditional release, he simply could have asked for a hearing.
I want to make clear, on the violation of the electronic home monitoring, what did he do that was a violation of the electronic home monitoring?
Well, I think based on the conditional release violation report, it indicates that he was given a furlough on a particular date and was not back where, you know, back at his home at the time he was supposed to be. And I think obviously at some point it's because he was in custody, but I don't know based on the report if he also, you know, failed to return, if he was supposed to be back, you know, hours before he was actually arrested. But it's clear that he was, you know, out of range and not home where he was supposed to be at the time.
Which argument that do you think is your strongest argument that you set forth in your brief for affirming?
I mean,
is it the electronic home monitoring or do you
oh,
think
in terms
the
of
waiver?
Which violation is the...
Well, or, yeah, I mean, you make several alternative arguments. I'm just wondering what you think is your strongest argument.
In the state's view, this case is incredibly straightforward. And it is just like Montez or just like Batchelor, and that this is not sort of broaching any new law. And when we look at sort of the vast array of non-precedential cases that this court has decided that are similar to this, this is squarely in line with those, that we have a straightforward violation of a conditional plea agreement, and then the district court was authorized to impose the higher sentence. So in the state's view, it's...
Even though there was judicial notice taken...
Yeah, I mean, I think that happens in these other cases, like Montez with the PSI. I mean, I think that there are other cases where it unfolds exactly like this. And I think, you know, frankly, below, appellant did not make a due process argument, and below, appellant did not ask for an evidentiary hearing. So, you know, if some other, extenuating circumstances existed wherein it would not be appropriate for the district court to make that type of finding, you know, appellant did not raise those arguments below. I'm happy to answer any other questions that the panel has any of this morning. Otherwise, the state rests on its brief and respectfully requests this court affirm the sentence.
Okay, thank you. Take your time, sir.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Sorry at all. Please take all the time you need.
I have a torn meniscus and no surgery until May 18th.
Oh, no.
It's the VA.
It's no fun. I've had a torn meniscus.
I did it in January.
Oh.
Your Honors, to begin with, I'd like to address what the state has suggested about their two cases, both Montez and Batchelor. To begin with, Montez is an opposite to this case. Because it involved a search made under a search warrant of the defendant's residence, and inculpatory statements that were made by both the defendant and the defendant's roommate. No inculpatory statements were taken or offered here. That is distinctual. And the case of Batchelor, that involved a defendant who failed to show up for court. I know of no judicial officer in the state of Minnesota who is incapable of noticing that the defendant is not in his or her courtroom. That is completely different than what we had here. Judge Cahill did not observe any of the violations. Instead, what he did was he took judicial notice of an administrative agency's document that would be unchallenged by his taking of judicial notice.
Is there a distinction, do you think, in a district court relying on a PSI versus the district court taking judicial notice of a conditional release violation report?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there's a huge distinction. No PSI, no full PSI was taken in this case, even though I requested it. I raised that issue in the hearing at transcript 4, page 4, lines 18 through 22, and Judge Cahill said it was in the record as Doc ID 52, but that was a Tier 1 felony sentencing report, not a full PSI. No PSI was conducted. A PSI, Your Honor, as I'm sure you all know, is different because it involves either the cooperation or the lack of cooperation of the defendant. In this case, no PSI was conducted, so there was it is entirely distinguishable between the two. Your Honor is correct. Obey all laws is different than don't get charged with anything else. Had the conditions of release, which were challenged in total, not just the statement that he had been arrested, but were the conditions he said didn't violate, I said he didn't violate the conditions of release, is different than a finding of probable cause. We all know how low the probable cause standard is. It's very low. We also don't know, as the state has conceded, what the rationale for that conditional violation report was, because they don't know whether he had violated before he was arrested. They don't know whether he was violating it after he was arrested. They only know that they received a document and introduced a document into the record. On Monday, Your Honors, this court issued a decision concerning a district court decision in the same district court before the same judge. And 17 times in that order, it used the word harmless. If magic words were not used and should have been used, that is nothing more than harmless error. And there's no reason why a citizen of the United States cannot take advantage of the doctrine of harmless error in the same way the state or district court would do. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame. That concludes our agenda for today. We are now adjourned.